Our fortune, our skilled talent, and all our other assets are combined for the sole purpose of giving the public the greatest possible amount of transportation service for the least possible cost. The success of our business has depended, very largely, upon our never having deviated from this policy. William Wrigley, Jr., the Chewing Gum King. What I think about concentrated effort can best be described by examining the 5-cent package of a chewing gum, to the manufacture and distribution of which I have devoted all my time. Temptations to divert my attention and some of my money into other channels have been many and varied, but I stuck to my original definite major purpose because I recognized early in life that no man can succeed if he splits his energies and diverts his attention in many different directions. Incidentally, Mr. Wrigley was the first student of my philosophy of American achievement after it had been organized and tested. Andrew Carnegie, the man who inspired the organization of the philosophy and directed the earlier stages of its organization, had a favorite slogan which he expressed on every appropriate occasion. It was this: "Place all your eggs in one basket, then watch the basket closely to see that no one kicks it over." By that he meant, of course, to concentrate all of one's attention upon a single definite major purpose. He did precisely that in the development of the great steel industry he founded and in the accumulation of his huge fortune. King Gillette, producer of the first practical safety razor. By concentrating all my attention and my fortune upon the production of a safety razor, I have not only fulfilled a mission in life that has given me great satisfaction and a stable fortune, but I have rendered a priceless service to millions of men who use my product. I have stuck to this one definite major purpose because I realized that an average lifetime is not long enough to permit one to attain more than one major goal. Edwin C. Barnes, national distributor of the Ediphone and the only business partner that Thomas A. Edison had. I have confined my efforts entirely to the sale and distribution of Ediphones, Edison dictating machines, because I learned from Mr. Edison, quite early in life, the benefits of concentrated effort. One of the first of Mr. Edison's traits of character which I observed was his habit of controlling his attention upon one thing at a time. While it is true that he created many different inventions, it must be remembered that he concentrated all of his attention in the field of invention, and always fixed his attention on one invention at a time. To this one habit, more than any other, perhaps, does he owe his astounding success as an inventor. John Wanamaker, the Merchant King of Philadelphia. Controlled attention behind a single purpose is the secret of all human achievement. The man who acquires this art and applies it skillfully thereby connects himself with a source of power that is not available to him through any other method. What this power is, how it can best be tapped and used, are questions beyond my sphere of activity, but I do know that it exists, for I have used it as the basis of all my business experience. And I can tell you this about it. It becomes, under certain circumstances, an irresistible power, sufficient for the solution of all human problems. James J. Hill, founder of the Great Northern Railway System. The man who spreads his energies over many different enterprises resembles the man who shuts his eyes when he aims at an object and fires a gun. He may spread his shot in many directions without hitting the target. Controlled attention has been my greatest asset. I have used it during most of the adult period of my life, and particularly in building and operating the Great Northern Railway. John D. Rockefeller, Sr., founder of the Standard Oil Company. From the very first day that I took my first job as a bookkeeper until this very moment, I have followed the plan of centering my attention upon one thing at a time. Controlled attention places a man in contact with a source of power that gives him what amounts to a sort of super wisdom in the management of his affairs. I have invested large sums of money in many different businesses and industries, but I earned this money in the business on which I have concentrated most of my thought, the oil business. No part of my attention has been given to any of the industries in which I have made investments, except my own. Wilbur Wright, co-inventor of the Wright airplane. My brother Orville and I always followed the habit of concentrating our attention upon one major purpose, and that was the perfecting of a heavier-than-air flying machine. If we had split our attention, I doubt that we would ever have built a machine that could have flown successfully. Frank W. Woolworth, founder of the Woolworth 5 and 10 cent stores. From the day that I originated the modern 5 and 10 cent store plan, I have devoted all my attention to my definite major purpose, the operation of our stores. Controlled attention played a much more important part in the success of our business than any other factor. Imitators soon entered the field with plans similar to our own, and some of them did quite well, but we remained steadfast in carrying out our original plan. Perhaps this is why we have been known as the leaders in this field for so many years. Arthur W. Nash, founder of the Nash made-to-order clothing business. Our real success began when we discovered that a business thrives best when everyone connected with it concentrates his mind upon the success of the business. Before we made this discovery, we were working at cross purposes. By combining definiteness of purpose, the golden rule applied, and controlled attention, we converted a business that was insolvent into a business that now pays adequate dividends to every person who works in it. The combination of these three principles gave us access to a source of power we had not been using before. George Pullman, inventor of the modern Pullman sleeping car. The change in my economic affairs came when I discovered that a man can do but one thing at a time, if he does it well. My entire time has been concentrated upon the refinement of the Pullman car. This has been responsible, more than anything else, for the success we have enjoyed. Julius Rosenwald, former owner of Sears Roebuck and Company. Controlled attention, in combination with definiteness of purpose, the golden rule applied, and creative vision, have made our company the acknowledged leader in the mail-order merchandising field. Of these latter three principles, I would emphasize the first, because without it, the other two would lose much of their economic significance. Milo C. Jones, the Wisconsin farmer who made a fortune after being stricken by double paralysis. After I lost the use of my body, I concentrated all the powers of my mind on a single idea, the making of little pig sausage, and I was amazed to learn that I could accomplish by controlled attention alone much more than I had previously been able to accomplish with the full use of my body. With the aid of the mastermind principle, I could use the physical capacities of other members of my family in the management of the business. But the planning that was necessary took place through the concentration of my own mind on that single purpose. Walter C. Chrysler, the founder of the Chrysler Motor Company. I agree with Andrew Carnegie that it is a sound policy for one to place all his eggs in one basket and then watch the basket. The better portion of my life has been devoted to the manufacture and sale of fine motor cars. I have concentrated all my energies on this one definite major purpose. It is surprising what a man can accomplish when he gains the necessary self-discipline to enable him to control his attention by holding it on one thing at a time. Whatever success I have attained has been largely the result of definiteness of purpose, the mastermind principle, creative vision, organized individual endeavor, self-discipline, and controlled attention, with strong emphasis on the latter. Many readers will remember that tragic year 1933, when Franklin D. Roosevelt became the president for his first term. The business depression had spread fear in the minds of the people, and the whole economic structure was in a state of wild chaos, with banks failing and businesses suspending, and men being thrown out of jobs by the tens of thousands. Scare headlines about the business depression filled the newspapers, and everyone was talking, thinking, and acting in terms of fear and doubt. Thomas A. Edison became the world's greatest inventor with practically no schooling, solely by learning to concentrate his full attention on one thing at a time. Being an experienced student of psychology, the president went to work to stop the stampede of fear. His first move was designed to make use of the principle of controlled attention, not on the part of a few, but on the part of all the people of the United States. Let us analyze his action, for here we find many of the principles of this philosophy in operation in a practical way, in one of the greatest emergencies this country has ever known. The President's first move was to call the leaders of both houses of Congress to the White House for a conference, at which he sold them the idea of forgetting party affiliations and concentrating all their efforts on the one task of reestablishing confidence in the minds of the American people. Then he called in the representatives of the newspapers and engaged them in a similar commitment. The church leaders were asked to engage in the same undertaking, regardless of their denomination, and they complied willingly. The radio announcers were enlisted in the same cause, and they went to work in earnest, selling Americanism to the people of America. The President himself inaugurated his famous Fireside Chats program and spoke directly to the American people. In these and other similar endeavors, too numerous to mention, the people of America were brought together in one master stroke, utilizing application of the principle of controlled attention, for the sole purpose of restoring confidence in the American way of life, in the American institutions, and above all, in the American people themselves. The results were like magic. Almost overnight, the scare headlines about business depression were dropped, and their places were filled with headlines about business recovery. Every adult remembers this circumstance, but one of the great tragedies of it lies in the fact that so few people caught the full significance of the power that brought this rapid change about, the power of controlled attention focused upon a definite major purpose. An emergency was at hand. In fact, it was a national emergency such as the people had never seen before. Spurred on by the seriousness of this emergency, the people dropped their personal prejudices of race, creed, and political leanings and concentrated their minds upon the one task of restoring confidence, with the result that the whole economic picture began to swing back from failure to success. Here is an impressive example of what happens when people blend their minds and place their combined mind power back of a definite major purpose in a spirit of controlled attention. The principle works as well for individuals as it worked for the nation as a whole. There is sufficient power available through any normal brain, if it is organized and directed to a definite end through controlled attention, to bring the solution of the individual's major problems of life, not to mention the solution of the minor problems, most of which would not exist if one followed the habit of controlled attention in dealing with these problems. Successful businessmen and others who have given thought to the subject have long known that the best way to deal with unpleasant problems is to tackle the hardest of them first, and to do it without fear or procrastination, by centering the attention upon it and keeping it there until a solution has been found. It is surprising to learn how quickly the most embarrassing problems will melt away into nothing when one concentrates his attention upon them with a determined will to liquidate them. But this is not the way the average person handles such problems. Most people handle unpleasant problems about the same way that the lazy housekeeper keeps house, by sweeping the dirt under the carpet. Little problems grow into big ones when left to run their course without attention. As one noted psychologist explained the power of controlled attention, it burns a hole straight through the heart of the knottiest of problems if one places back of it a determined will. And he might well have added that controlled attention not only burns a hole through the heart of a problem, but it keeps on until it liquidates what is left around the hole. The late Cyrus H. K. Curtis, the former owner of the Saturday Evening Post, had this to say about the principle of controlled attention. "When I first purchased the Saturday Evening Post, it consisted mainly of its name and some debts. My definite major purpose was to make the Post the greatest magazine property in the United States. Back of this aim, I concentrated all my attention, all my money, and all my influence with my friends, with a faith in the future of the magazine which had no limitations. Because of lack of operating capital, the first years of the Post were fraught with difficulties sufficient to have discouraged anyone with less faith than I had. There were times when I owed more money than I could have raised if I had sold everything I possessed, including the post, and sometimes my creditors were not generous. My closest friends begged me to give up the post and devote my efforts to something requiring less work and less operating capital, but I had committed myself to do a job, and I was determined to do it, no matter how long it required or what effort had to be put into it. I went through many years of this sort of experience, some of them pushing me so far into the red that it looked as if I might never get out. That is, it looked that way to everyone except myself. All through those years of hardship, I kept my mind concentrated on the job ahead of me, and not on the pleadings of my friends who wished me to give it up and quit. I have always felt a contempt for a quitter, and especially the quitter who gives up before he has made an earnest effort to win. Now the big fight is over, and I have won. I have made the post exactly what I started out to make it, a fact to which even my competitors will testify. Would I go through the same fight again if I had to do it over again? Why, yes, of course I would. There is a sort of compensation that is experienced by the man who has had a stiff fight but has won the battle, a form of compensation which I fear others never know. Whenever you see a copy of the Saturday Evening Post, just say to yourself, here is physical evidence that controlled attention, backed by definiteness of purpose, cannot be defeated. That is about the way the story goes with all men who have attained noteworthy success. All of them go through their testing time, as Andrew Carnegie expressed it, that shows what sort of metal they are made of. I have never heard of any person achieving great success without having gone through difficulties and unpleasant experiences, and the one quality which best stands out during these periods of testing time is controlled attention. The Saturday Evening Post is now one of the great magazines of the country. It is the envy of the magazine publishers' field, but we wonder if the millions of people who read it each week ever take the time to study its early history, or know that it is the product of one man's mind, a man who had vision and imagination and enthusiasm and personal initiative and the fortitude to carry on when the going was hard. I wonder, too, how many people recognize that the greatness of the Saturday Evening Post, as compared with many other magazines that have come and gone since its birth, is measured in almost exact proportion to the difficulties through which Cyrus H. K. Curtis nursed it during its early history. I have singled out the Saturday Evening Post because almost everyone is acquainted with it. The same illustration might well be applied to almost any other great industry, for always there is some one person, or a small group of persons, who concentrate their minds upon a definite purpose and carry a business through its testing time before success arrives. Perhaps there is no greater example in all history of the power of concentrated effort than that which is associated with the history of our own country. The American way of life, as we know it today, was born of struggle and hardship and personal sacrifice that has rarely, if ever, been experienced by those of us who enjoy the privileges of this country. It would pay every reader to spend a few evenings reading of the early history of the United States, especially that portion of it which began with the Declaration of Independence, when 56 brave men signed their names to the most important compact designed to bring freedom to a people that the world has ever known. Today, the people of the United States, as well as the people of most of the other countries of the world, are faced by a world emergency which threatens the destruction of the great American way of life, with all of its blessings and rights of personal liberty and its abundance of opportunities. As I take inventory of what is happening in this country to destroy the unity of the people, I am puzzled to know why the people do not profit from the experience of those brave men who gave the country its solidity and its security when the country was young and weak. I want, too, to know why the people have so soon forgotten the methods by which the President of the United States stopped the stampede of fear in 1933 and reestablished temporary confidence through the principle of controlled attention backed by a definite purpose. If these principles were sound in the past, they must be equally as sound today. If unity of the people were helpful a little over 165 years ago, when the nation was being wrested from tyranny, such solidarity should be equally helpful today in our present crisis. And we might well add that if this principle were helpful to the nation as a whole, it may be equally helpful to any small group who set out to accomplish a desirable end under the mastermind principle. Wherever people coordinate their efforts in a spirit of harmony for the attainment of a definite purpose and begin to work for its attainment, they find themselves aided by a mysterious power which gives momentum to their efforts. If they happen to be martyrs who have been brought together through persecution, the power available to them is, for some strange reason, apparently increased. About 100 years ago, a man by the name of Joseph Smith founded a religion known as Mormonism. A religious war sprang up in the community where Smith and his followers lived, which resulted in the murder of him and his brother Hiram while they were confined in a jail in Illinois. The leadership of the group was taken over by Brigham Young, who moved a majority of them into the then wilderness of Utah, 2,000 miles from the more populous section of the United States. They carried with them barely enough food and seed for planting and utensils for household and farming purposes to keep them from starving to death. After cutting their way through 2,000 miles of wilderness, fighting Indians and battling against the elements, they finally arrived at what is now Salt Lake City, Utah, and settled. They planted what seed they carried with them, but it had no sooner sprouted above the ground than it was set upon by grasshoppers and almost devoured. To add to their miseries, the United States government sent soldiers to Utah, ostensibly to put down polygamy. They went at the job so crudely that they antagonized the entire Mormon population, but the Mormons held out, and the little colony survived. The stories told by the Mormons of their sacrifices were almost unbelievable, but they have been substantiated in all of the essential details. The years went by, and the Mormons grew and prospered, making their living entirely from the soil. It is generally conceded that no group of people throughout the pioneering days of this country, from the early Pilgrim settlers on down to the present, were harassed and persecuted as severely as were the Mormons. Today, a little less than 100 years after the Mormons settled in Utah, we find them a peaceful and prosperous people, still making their living, for the most part, from the soil of the earth. During the Depression, while millions of people were on government relief throughout the nation, the Mormons were the first to announce that thereafter no Mormon would ask for charity. They had found a way to become self-sustaining and determining. Now, we are not interested in the Mormon religion as such, nor are we interested in the Mormon people, except to call attention to what happens when a group of people is driven to martyrdom, as the Mormons were. Here we have a convincing example of the soundness of Andrew Carnegie's motto that adversity carries with it the seed of an equivalent benefit. The Mormons met with adversity on a scale almost beyond human endurance. As to the merits or demerits of their cause, or their religion, or their former domestic relationships, we are in no way interested. But we are keenly interested in learning the secret by which a group of people may so combine their fortunes and their efforts that each individual may get the necessities of life without asking for public charity. Study the Mormons carefully, and you will find that the secret of their self-determination, if there is anything about it that can be called secret, dates back to the spirit of perseverance which they developed while fighting for their lives. They were driven to pool their scant economic resources and their spiritual resources for their defense against a society that was trying to exterminate them. In forming that pool, they discovered something which should be of keen interest to the rest of us. They discovered that there is power in unity of purpose and coordination of physical effort. They not only discovered the mastermind principle, but they used it to save themselves from total annihilation, and used it to save themselves from the humility of accepting public charity in an era when millions of other people who were never persecuted were seeking subsidy through government relief. The Mormons not only understand the principle of controlled attention, but that principle has been used by them so successfully that they have wrested victory from defeat in a world that was bent upon destroying them. Their application of this principle was at first a matter of necessity. They were forced to concentrate their attention upon a definite major purpose or be annihilated. Later, perhaps, they began making use of the principle out of preference, because they had learned of its stupendous power while fighting for existence. Before leaving the subject of the Mormons, I wish to make one other observation concerning them. Today, they have missionaries in practically every part of the United States and in most of the countries of the world. Having made a place for themselves under the most severe conditions, they are now being recognized throughout the world as favorably as they were once persecuted. There is no spirit of revenge among the Mormon people today. If they ever felt revengeful for the persecution they were forced to undergo, it has now been subdued. They hold no grudges against anyone on that score. Perhaps that may be one reason why they are being accepted so freely throughout the world. Their mental attitude is positive and constructive. They are loyal American citizens, conforming in every way to the best and most approved habits of the American way of life. In all this country, no finer example of the soundness of Emerson's essay on compensation can be found than that of the Mormons. That which was taken from them by the generation of 100 years ago is now being freely and willingly repaid to them by this generation. Here is food for thought of the highest order. Let us recognize truth wherever we find it. Moreover, let us appropriate truth and make use of it, no matter from what source it may come. If the Mormons have a better way of relating themselves to one another than have the rest of us, let us discover their way and make use of it. Let us be fair, to ourselves at least, and analyze the Mormon way of life, not by their habits of 100 years ago, but their habits of today. The whole world is in a state of maladjustment. Human relationships have been disturbed in this and all other countries to a point of danger which threatens civilization. It behooves us, therefore, to observe the methods of any individual or group of individuals who have found a way to relate themselves to life harmoniously. When we find even one person who has discovered how to live harmoniously with the rest of the world, let us inquire into his philosophy, for despite the fact we may come into his presence to scoff, we may find it advantageous to remain and pray. Controlled attention makes this sort of analysis possible. It enables one to pierce the outer covering of things and people as they appear to be, and to learn what exists under the covering. The world needs this sort of analysis right now. Most of us are too much inclined to view the outward appearances and the material aspects of things and people, overlooking the reality that lies underneath. And this tragic habit has brought the whole world to the very brink of spiritual bankruptcy. This philosophy was intended, originally, as a philosophy of individual achievement, designed mainly to enable people to procure the material needs of life without violating the rights of others. Mr. Carnegie had this in mind when he inspired the research which resulted in the philosophy. But the changed conditions of the world since Mr. Carnegie's time have led me to look at an entirely new world. A world of spiritual wealth, a world in which the finer arts of human relationship have been revealed, and it is the greater spirit of understanding that I wish the reader of this chapter to acquire. I have endeavored to show that there is a difference between controlled attention and ordinary concentration of efforts. Let us make sure that we understand the nature and extent of this difference. The word control is the key to the explanation of the difference. Controlled attention means the act of coordinating all the faculties of the mind and directing their combined power to a given end. Such is an act which requires self-discipline of the highest order. It also requires the development of controlled habits. As a matter of fact, one cannot control attention without the supporting influence of well-developed habits of thought. Now, let us consider some of the circumstances under which controlled attention is applied, viz. A. Prayer. When one prays, if he understands the true meaning of prayer, and prays in a state of mind that has been cleared of all fear and doubt, he does so by setting aside his own faculty of reason, his faculty of will, and all other faculties of the mind, except the faculty of the emotions. With the mind under control, he concentrates all his positive emotions, especially the emotion of faith, on the object of his prayer, having such a deep faith in its attainment that he can see himself already in possession of it. Under this sort of controlled attention, one makes direct contact with infinite intelligence. If the prayer is answered favorably, the answer comes in the form of an inspired idea, plan, or method by which one may, through his own efforts, acquire that for which he prays. The words used in prayer are immaterial. The state of mind in which the prayer is offered is the thing that counts. The factor of faith must be present. The slightest shade of fear or doubt or indecision in connection with one's right to get that for which he prays will bring negative results. The mind must be free from every other thought except that connected with the object of the prayer. The prayer must continue until it produces the desired results. Sometimes this happens within a matter of seconds. At other times, the answer may be deferred for hours, days, months, or years, according to the nature of the prayer and what is necessary for its fulfillment. Prayer expressed in times of emergency, when the mind is dominated by fear, has seldom been known to produce the desired results, although the one who prays may be in great need of aid. Prayer based on a request for something which would call for the cessation of natural law or the circumvention or violation of natural law will bring negative results. Prayer asking for results that would damn others fails also, and for the very understandable reason that the person who makes such a request has in his mind some form of revenge, greed, selfishness, or other negative emotion which renders the prayer ineffective. Successful prayer depends upon adequate preparation of the mind for the expression of prayer. That preparation is controlled attention based on faith. Prayer is power. Dr. Alexis Carroll, who devoted 33 years to biological research at the Rockefeller Institute and is the author of Man the Unknown, analyzed prayer as follows. Prayer is not only worship. It is also an invisible emanation of man's worshiping spirit, the most powerful form of energy that one can generate. The influence of prayer on the human mind and body is as demonstrable as that of secreting glands. Its results can be measured in terms of increased physical buoyancy, greater intellectual vigor, moral stamina, and a deeper understanding of the realities underlying human relationships. If you make a habit of sincere prayer, your life will be very noticeably and profoundly altered. Prayer stamps with its indelible mark our actions and demeanor. A tranquility of bearing, a facial and bodily repose, are observed in those whose inner lives are thus enriched. Within the depths of consciousness, a flame kindles, and man sees himself. He discovers himself. He discovers his selfishness, his silly pride, his fears, his greed, his blunders. He develops a sense of moral obligation, intellectual humility. Thus begins a journey of the soul toward the realm of grace. Prayer is a force as real as terrestrial gravity. As a physician, I have seen men, after all other therapy had failed, lifted out of disease and melancholy by the serene effort of prayer. It is the only power in the world that seems to overcome the so-called laws of nature. The occasions on which prayer has dramatically done this have been termed miracles. But a constant, quieter miracle takes place hourly in the hearts of men and women who have discovered that prayer supplies them with a steady flow of sustaining power in their daily lives. Too many people regard prayer as a formalized routine of words, a refuge for weaklings, or a childish petition for material things. We sadly undervalue prayer when we conceive it in these terms, just as we should underestimate rain by describing it as something that fills the birdbath in our garden. Properly understood, prayer is a mature activity indispensable to the fullest development of personality, the ultimate integration of man's highest faculties. Only in prayer do we achieve that complete and harmonious assembly of body, mind, and spirit which gives the frail human reed its unshakable strength. The words, "Ask and it shall be given to you," have been verified by the experience of humanity. True, prayer may not restore a dead child to life or bring relief from physical pain, but prayer, like radium, is a source of luminous, self-generating energy. How does prayer fortify us with so much dynamic power? To answer this question, admittedly outside the jurisdiction of science, I must point out that all prayers have one thing in common: the triumphant hosannas of a great oratorio or the humble supplication of an Iroquois hunter begging for luck in the chase demonstrate the same truth, that human beings seek to augment their finite energy by addressing themselves to the infinite source of all energy. When we pray, we link ourselves with the inexhaustible motive power that spins the universe. We ask that a part of this power be apportioned to our needs. Even in asking, our human deficiencies are minimized, and we arise strengthened and repaired. But we must never summon God merely for the gratification of our whims. We derive most power from prayer when we use it not as a petition, but as a supplication that we may become more like Him. Prayer should be regarded as practice of the presence of God. An old peasant was seated alone in the last pew of the village church. "What are you waiting for?" he was asked, and he answered, "I am looking at him, and he is looking at me." Man prays not only that God should remember him, but also that he should remember God. How can prayer be defined? Prayer is the effort of man to reach God, to commune with an invisible being, creator of all things, supreme wisdom, truth, beauty, and strength, father and redeemer of each man. This goal of prayer always remains hidden to intelligence, for both language and thought fail when we attempt to describe God. We do know, however, that whenever we address God in fervent prayer, we change both soul and body for the better. It could not happen that any man or woman could pray for a single moment without some good result. "No man ever prayed," said Emerson, "without learning something." One can pray everywhere, in the streets, the subways, the office, the shop, the school, as well as in the solitude of one's own room or among the crowd in a church. There is no prescribed posture, time, or place. "Think of God more often than you breathe," said Epictetus the Stoic. In order really to mold personality, prayer must become a habit. It is meaningless to pray in the morning and to live like a barbarian the remainder of the day. True prayer is a way of life. The truest life is literally a way of prayer. The best prayers are like the improvisations of gifted lovers, always about the same thing, yet never twice the same. We cannot all be as creative in prayer as St. Teresa or Bernard of Clairvaux, both of whom poured their adoration into words of mystical beauty. Fortunately, we do not need their eloquence. Our slightest impulse to prayer is recognized by God. Even if we are pitifully dumb, or if our tongues are overlaid with vanity or deceit, our meager syllables of praise are acceptable to Him, and He showers us with strengthening manifestations of His love. Today, as never before, prayer is a binding necessity in the lives of men and nations. The lack of emphasis on the religious sense has brought the world to the edge of destruction. Our deepest source of power and perfection has been left miserably undeveloped. Prayer, the basic exercise of the spirit, must be actively practiced in our private lives. The neglected soul of man must be made strong enough to assert itself once more. For if the power of prayer is again released and used in the lives of common men and women, if the Spirit declares its aims clearly and boldly, there is yet hope that our prayers for a better world will be answered. Quoted by permission from the Reader's Digest. B. Definiteness of Purpose. Here, one must understand the full significance of Andrew Carnegie's emphasis on the relationship of perfect harmony between all the minds of a mastermind group. Lack of harmony on the part of one individual of the group will destroy the controlled attention feature of the alliance. It is obvious, therefore, that controlled attention is more easily attained by an individual than it is by a group of individuals, because of the difficulty in bringing together a group of people, all of whom will subordinate their personal desires and motives for the attainment of a common end. The Mormon people accomplished this end But they were inspired to do so by one of the strongest of all motives, the desire for self-preservation. It is very easy for one to subordinate his personal desires for the good of his associates when his very life depends upon mutual coordination of effort, in spirit as well as in deed. Mr. Carnegie has called attention time and again to the necessity of perfect harmony in a mastermind alliance. His genius in maintaining that relationship between the members of his mastermind group and himself was the major secret of his stupendous achievements. He so arranged his relationship with his mastermind allies that all of them became wealthy far beyond anything they might have accomplished working independently without his aid. Being the astute judge of human nature that he was, he recognized that men control their attention because of adequate motive, and for no other reason. He provided his mastermind allies with many motives for cooperating with him in a spirit of perfect harmony, not the least of these being the desire for financial gain. Sales managers who understand practical psychology often inspire their salesmen to exert extra effort by holding out to them extra compensation in the form of bonuses, prizes, personal privileges, etc. The more successful sales managers usually manage to have some sort of a system of extra compensation in operation all of the time, because experience has proved that this is the best-known method of inducing men to take possession of their own minds and work toward a common end in a spirit of harmony. The sales manager of less experience often resorts to other methods for sales production results, such as holding his salesmen in fear of the loss of their jobs. Such methods sometimes produce temporary results that seem to be satisfactory, but they are only temporary. Permanent success in any sort of human relationship must be founded on mutual confidence and the spirit of harmony. Human relationships based on any other foundation are destined to fail, no matter what may be the nature of the relationship or for what purpose it is formed. Let us all remember this with profit. The world is now passing through an emergency when most of the people seem to have overlooked the importance of harmonious human relationships. There can be no harmony of human relationships in a world that is dominated by selfishness, greed, envy, revenge, hatred, lust, avarice, fear, doubt, indecision, and the desire for something for nothing, which are so evident throughout the world today. There can be no peace of mind or permanent success for the individual who is dominated by any of these negative states of mind. Controlled attention is one of the major principles by which all negative states of mind may be eliminated. In a recent radio address, Pope Pius expressed the opinion that the world war is God's way of purging a sin-sick world of its sins. Common sense suggests that the people of the world, with exceptions, of course, have been relating themselves to one another since the beginning of the first war in a manner deserving of correction. C. Love. Here is a state of mind, a human emotion, which heads the entire list of all emotions for effectiveness in establishing harmonious relationships between people. Love is of the spirit. It is of divine origin. If you wish to see controlled attention in operation in its highest form, observe the man and woman who have consolidated their interests in a spirit of love. Observe also how easily this state of mind clears the mind of all other thoughts. Where true love prevails, the presence of envy, greed, revenge, lust, selfishness, and the desire for something for nothing claim no part of the minds of the lovers. I am not referring to that form of sentimentalism known as puppy love, nor the emotion of sex, which is often mistaken for love. I am speaking of that spiritual power which brings people together in a spirit of oneness, that relationship through which each person becomes, spiritually, a part of the other. Love is spiritual harmony between two people. The relationship is not confined to men and women. It is the sort of relationship that exists between people wherever the true spirit of Christianity prevails. It has nothing in common with dogma or creed. It is the highest form of human intercourse. Where it becomes the dominating factor in human relationships, harmony and understanding exist. It is controlled attention directed to a definiteness of purpose among people. He whom it affects recognizes willingly that he is his brother's keeper. It was this divine spirit of love which inspired the signers of the Declaration of Independence voluntarily and willingly to pawn their own lives in order that liberty might be the common privilege of their fellow men. Their motive had nothing of the nature of selfishness in it. It had no relationship to fear. It was the product of an enduring faith that was shared alike by 56 men who were so sure of the justice of their cause that they saw it triumphant at the outset. Wherever men control their attention and direct it to a definite end in this spirit, they avail themselves of a source of power which may successfully defy opposition. That sort of power never is used by despots, for it is an impossibility to use spiritual power destructively. Spiritual power builds, but never tears down. Controlled attention leads to mastery in any sort of endeavor because it enables one to focus the powers of his mind upon a definite objective and keep it so directed at will. Controlled attention is self-mastery of the highest order, for it is an accepted fact that the man who can control his own mind can control everything that gets in his way. The man who knows exactly what he wants and who concentrates his attention upon getting it with the full backing of his will to win usually is not disappointed. Nothing can defeat him except a stronger opposing will. That sort of concentrated effort finds a way to master obstacles which seem insurmountable. It was this sort of willpower that Harriet Beecher Stowe had in mind when she wrote, "When you get into a tight place and everything goes against you, until it seems as though you could not hold on a minute longer, never give up then, for that is just the place and time that the tide will turn." Yes, the tide seems always to turn in one's favor if one is determined to see that it does. The state of mind has a lot to do with the tide. Plato had in mind this same thought when he said, "The first and best victory is to conquer self. To be conquered by self is, of all things, the most shameful and vile." Every great philosopher who has given thought to the powers of the mind has discovered that the mind has within it qualities sufficient for every emergency. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow recognized the truth of this when he said, "An enlightened mind is not hoodwinked. It is not shut up in a gloomy prison till it thinks the walls of its own dungeon are the limits of the universe, and the reach of its own chain the outer verge of intelligence." While Longfellow did not try to explain the source of the mind's power, he definitely recognized the irresistible power of the mind, just as every deep thinker recognizes it. Parkman showed his understanding of the mind, and particularly the power of a concentrated mind, when he wrote, "He who would do some great thing in this short life must apply himself to work with such concentration of his forces as, to idle spectators, who live only to amuse themselves, looks like insanity." And Annie Besant expressed her deep and mature understanding of the power that is available through the mind when she said, "Knowledge is essential to conquest. Only according to our ignorance are we helpless. Thought creates character. Character can dominate conditions. Will creates circumstances and environment." Thomas Fowell Buxton expressed a great truth in connection with the power of concentrated thought when he wrote, "The longer I live, the more deeply I am convinced that that which makes the difference between one man and another, between the weak and the powerful, the great and the insignificant, is energy, invincible determination, a purpose once formed, and then death or victory." Every man who has triumphed over prolonged defeat will understand the meaning of Buxton's statement. Arnold Bennett expressed his understanding of mind power when he said, "The manner in which one single ray of light, one single precious hint, will clarify and energize the whole mental life of him who receives it is among the most wonderful and heavenly of intellectual phenomena. I think it rather fine, this necessity for the tense bracing of the will before anything worth doing can be done. I feel it is the chief thing that differentiates men from the cat by the fire." Whenever one tunes in on the thoughts of men who really think, he discovers evidence of their recognition of the irresistible power of the mind when that power is organized and turned to a definite purpose. Man is not a creature of circumstances, but a creator of circumstances. He makes his own circumstances, his own opportunities. John Quincy Adams expressed his belief in the profound nature of the power of the mind in these words, "Courage and perseverance have a magic talisman before which difficulties disappear and obstacles vanish into air." Washington Irving expressed his respect for the powers of the mind when he said, "Great minds have purposes, others have wishes. Little minds are tamed and subdued by misfortune, but great minds rise above them." Yes, that is true. Great minds do rise above misfortunes, and let us not forget that one of the qualities which make a great mind is that of definiteness of purpose backed by concentration of effort. John Foster expressed a great truth concerning the influence of a positive mind that is backed by determination when he said, "When a firm, decisive spirit is recognized, it is curious to see how the space clears around a man and leaves him room and freedom." I have observed the truth of this many times by watching a determined man who knew where he was going as he walked down the street. I have actually seen people look back over their shoulders, become confused, and quickly sidestep out of his way. The determined mind projects an influence that is felt by everyone within its range. You can recognize that sort of mind the moment one who possesses it walks into a room that is crowded by people, even though you may not actually see the man. His presence makes itself felt. Ralph Waldo Emerson disclosed his profound understanding of the power of thought in these words, "The key to every man is his thought. Beware when the great God lets loose a thinker on this planet." I take you now to Mr. Carnegie's analysis of this concept, but I wish to remind you that the method by which the habit of controlled attention can best be developed has been described in the first portion of this chapter. Mr. Carnegie's analysis will deal mainly with the effects of controlled attention, rather than the method by which this desirable habit may be acquired. Andrew Carnegie's Analysis of Controlled Attention. The analysis begins in Mr. Carnegie's private study in 1908, when I first met and interviewed him. Hill. Mr. Carnegie, will you describe how controlled attention can be applied in the practical affairs of life? Carnegie.
Now let us define the term controlled attention and make sure we understand exactly what it means. It is the act of combining all the faculties of the mind and concentrating them upon the attainment of a definite purpose. The time involved in the act of concentration of thought on a given subject depends upon the nature of the subject and upon that which one expects in connection with it. Take my own case, for example. The dominating forces of my mind are, and have been for many years, concentrated upon the making and the marketing of steel. I have others allied with me who likewise concentrate their dominating thoughts upon the same objective. Thus, we have the benefit of controlled attention in collective form, consisting, as it does, of the individual mind power of a great number of people, all working toward the same end in a spirit of harmony.
Hill. Could you not have carried on other business activities just as successfully as you conducted the steel industry, and at the same time? Wouldn't the mastermind principle have made this possible?
Carnegie.
Yes, I have known men to conduct many separate, unrelated businesses successfully with the aid of the master mind, but I have always believed they would have done much better had they confined their efforts entirely to one line of business. Splitting one's attention has the effect of dividing one's powers. The best plan for anyone to follow is to devote all his energies to some specific field. This concentration enables one to specialize in that field.
Hill. But what about the doctors who engage in general practice? Do they not have a better opportunity to add to their income than those who specialize in one particular branch of medicine?
Carnegie. No, the exact opposite is true. If you ever have occasion to engage a specialist to remove your appendix, as I have had, you will learn that specialization in medicine pays. When I was a small boy,
The old family physician who used to look after the health of the people of our neighborhood would have removed an appendix for $25, and I suspect he could have done the job about as well as the specialist who charged me more than 10 times that amount. But I called in the specialist just the same. Hill. Does this same rule apply in the field of retail merchandising? Carnegie. Yes, it applies in every line of business and every calling. Modern merchandising has practically made the old-fashioned general store obsolete. While the most prosperous stores are departmentalized, they are not the same as the old general merchandise stores, because each department is managed by a specialist who devotes all his time to that department. You might say that a modern department store is nothing but a group of highly specialized stores, all operating under one roof and one general overhead, but possessing increased buying power that gives the store a tremendous advantage over smaller stores. Hill. You would say, then, that the department store is managed under the principle of controlled attention? Carnegie. That and other principles of the philosophy of individual achievement, especially the mastermind principle and definiteness of purpose. Hill. What about the banking business? Is it managed also by application of the principle of controlled attention? Carnegie. Very much so. Every department of a large bank, and practically every individual position in each department, is highly specialized. The same is true of railroading. Practically every position in the railroad business is specialized. Promotions are from the bottom upward, and the men holding the more responsible positions have had training in nearly all the subordinate positions, but they never undertake to hold 2 jobs at the same time. It is the same in the steel industry. Men become highly skilled by confining their efforts to specialized work. Here, too, promotions are from the bottom upward. All of our head men have served their apprenticeship in subordinate jobs in the operating end of the business. Hill. You believe, then, that the better opportunities of the future will be available to those who concentrate their efforts along some specialized lines? Carnegie. It has always been that way, and it always will be. Hill. What about the profession of teaching? Is it not possible for a teacher to prepare himself to teach many different subjects? Carnegie. Oh, yes, it is possible, but not advisable. The big universities are nothing but a group of associated colleges, each specializing in some particular branch of education. If it were practical for a teacher to do better work by devoting his efforts to a diversity of subjects, the universities would have discovered this long ago. Hill. What about the student who is preparing himself for a life work? Should he specialize in some particular branch of education? Carnegie. Yes, if he knows what his definite major purpose in life is to be. Otherwise, he should confine his efforts to a general educational course until such time as he chooses a goal. Then he should continue his education through specialized training. The lawyer, for example, usually takes a course in general education.